Good morning. The Senate Education Committee meeting is called to order. Today is Friday, February 25th, 2022. The time is 9:04 a.m. We're meeting State Capitol Room number 205. Senators in attendance are Senator Hughes, Senator Michicki, Senator Begich, myself as Chair, Senator Holland, Senator Stevens will probably join us shortly. I didn't check to see. Thank you to Mary Gwen, our recording secretary, and Kelsey, our moderator for today. As a reminder, please silence your cell phones. All right. At this time, we will bring Senate Bill 198 before the committee. Senate Bill 198 is related to Rampart School formally joining the Yukon-Koyukuk School District. This is the first hearing for Senate Bill 198 in the 32nd legislature, and I believe Heidi Teschner has taken the presenter's table. Ms. Teschner, please state your name and affiliation for the record, and then introduce this governor's bill.
Yes, good morning. For the record, Heidi Teschner, Acting Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Education and Early Development, and thank you for this opportunity to present the governor's bill on Rampart bill to you this morning, Senate Bill 198, an act providing that Rampart School is located within the Yukon-Koyukuk School District. I do want to start out by saying that Commissioner Johnson was hoped to be here this morning, but he's been traveling, and he wanted me to express his wholehearted support for this bill and his plea for it to urge a quick passage of it to help the students of Rampart. To explain the bill to the committee, so Rampart School is currently part of the Yukon Flats School District, meaning that it is located within that school district's boundaries. However, by a mutual agreement, a memorandum of agreement, the Yukon-Koyukuk School District has been administering and operating the Rampart School for several years since fiscal year 2017. So we're currently in the sixth year of that memorandum of agreement. Back in April of 2019, the administration tried to, signed a decisional memorandum to effectively place Rampart into Yukon-Koyukuk School District's boundaries, but that could not happen through an administrative process. It found out that that agreement did not allow the residents of the Yukon of Rampart to participate in and vote for Yukon-Koyukuk school board members because that agreement did not and could not authorize a modification to the school district's actual boundaries. So our regional educational attendance areas are part of the unorganized borough, and pursuant to Article 10, Section 6 of the Alaska Constitution, the legislature serves as the assembly for that unorganized borough. School district boundaries cannot be changed by an administrative agreement, rather only by a legislative action, which is why this bill is before you today. This is pursuant to Alaska Statute 29.03.020, which states, allowing for maximum local participation, the legislature may establish, alter, or abolish service areas within the unorganized borough to provide special services that may include schools. So Senate Bill 198 allows for that maximum local participation with the Yukon-Koyukuk School Board. And the legislature is the appropriate entity to authorize, allowing the Rampart School to become part of Yukon-Koyukuk School District. The community of Rampart is culturally and historically aligned to the communities in Yukon-Koyukuk, and both school districts support placing the Rampart School within Yukon-Koyukuk School District. The passage of Senate Bill 198 would result in a boundary change between these two regional education attendance areas, thereby by allowing parents of children at the Rampart School to participate in school board elections applicable to their community school. Chair Holland, that summarizes my opening comments on the bill. We do have, hopefully, on the line, a representative from Yukon Flats School District, Lori Thomas, the president of the school board, and also Kerry Boyd, the superintendent of Yukon-Koyukuk, is available on Teams, and Fred Beifelt, the chair board for Yukon-Koyukuk, should also be on the line.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Teschner. Are there any questions for the administration? And seeing none, we will go to Lori Thomas, as you mentioned, President Yukon Flats School District. I believe she's on the phone. President Thomas, if you can hear me, please state your name, your affiliation, and your location, and begin any invited testimony you may have to offer.
Okay, yes. Good morning. My name is Lori Thomas. I'm the school board president of the Yukon Flats School District. I reside in Fort Yukon, Alaska, and I've served on this board for a number of years, like 20 years. And so I know a lot of the history with the Rampart School, and I am particularly, as a school board member and serving with my school board, we had to close Rampart School many years ago when Rampart is in our district, Yukon Flats. And then several years ago, when Rampart approached us as they wanted to reopen their school, and so I'm not sure of the date, but it had to be close to 10 years ago, or maybe 6 to 10 years ago. And so myself and some school board members went to Rampart to meet with community members and the tribal administrator at that time, and then we had a meeting, and we all voted, the school board voted to reopen their school. And then as their school was opening and they had, you know, their enrollment, then it came about that logistically, being where it was located, it seemed more prudent for Yukon Koyukuk School District to support them because of where they were at logistically. And so the board, we obtained a memorandum of agreement with between the two school districts, and every year the Yukon Flats School District would, at the beginning of in the fall, we would see the memorandum of agreement between Yukon Koyukuk School District and Yukon Flats, and we would unanimously vote to approve that memorandum of agreement. And so the YK School District, they took over, and then it was discussed between our two districts of this eventually coming to what is Senate Bill number 198. And so our board, you know, we have this discussion every fall, and we all agreed that we were in favor of YK, redistricting Rampart to YK School District. So on behalf of the Yukon Flats School District, I approve the request to redistrict Rampart to the Yukon Koyukuk School District. I'm Lori Thomas.
All right. President Thomas, thanks so much. I also see we have Carrie Boyd, Superintendent of YK School District. If you care to offer any invited testimony on this.
Yes, thank you, Chairman Thompson. Members of the Senate Education Committee, good morning. My name is Carrie Boyd, and I am the superintendent of Yukon Koyukuk School District. I've been here for over 15 years, and I would like to support Senate Bill 198. It's a very simple bill that moves Rampart School into Yukon Koyukuk School District permanently. It's something that our school board has supported for years. And, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to give you just a little bit of background on the process over the years we've been going through. As you know, Rampart is located in Yukon Flats, and discussion about moving Rampart into Yukon Koyukuk School District began when Rampart Village Council, in a letter dated April 9, 2016, requested that Rampart School be moved into Yukon Flats. Moved from Yukon Flats to Yukon Koyukuk. Discussions where everyone was in agreement. We signed the memorandum of agreement. We had our school district attorneys involved to make sure that everything was done properly. And since July 1st, 2017, the MOA has been in continuous effect through annual approval of both boards. Eventually, we began to seek ways to make a permanent move. A boundary change was something both districts recognized. We both have been wanting this for years. For example, a permanent boundary change would allow residents of Rampart to participate in the YKSD school board elections. Currently, they are unable to do so. And in our REAAs, we all have committee, like a PAC committees, and right now they are in Yukon Flat, so that is unable to do that. The Division of Elections could not use the Memorandum of Agreement to recognize the Village of Rampart in YKSD. We did ask. In addition to administering and managing the school's operation, YKSD would like to maintain Rampart's facilities and buildings. A permanent boundary change for the district would help clear up any property and ownership titles questions with that. Currently, we do not own that building. Annual approval of the agreement, it consumes hours. Every year, we're back at it, trying to make this permanent. The bill that's presented before you is very simple and straightforward. And since 2018, we have worked with our local legislators, we've worked with the executive branch and with other agencies, and we've asked to make this boundary change. We thought we found a solution. In April 11, 2019, the commissioners of DCCED indeed signed a decisional memorandum to recognize a permanent school district boundary change for Rampart to be included. However, on August 1st, 2019, the director of the Division of Elections sent us a letter that said they could not recognize that decisional memorandum to change the school district boundary for Rampart. The reason was the Department of Law felt the commissioner's decisional memorandum did not have the force of law. On September of 2019, the local boundary commission staff wrote to inform both school districts that the decisional memorandum no longer existed. So you can imagine we were pretty disappointed. Over the past 2 years, we've went back and forth with the Department of Law on how to best proceed, which brings us here today. And we are seeking a permanent resolution to be included in our school district. The state of Alaska also needs a permanent resolution. Continuing with MOA is something that both districts really do not want to continue for numerous reasons just stated. So I ask Chairman Holland and members of the Senate, Ed, if you would help us get this done. It's been many years. As I said, I've been superintendent for over 15 years. I really would like to have this completed before I retire. Our board president, Fred Beifelt, our vice president, Shirley Kruger, and the rest of our board are very much in support of this. And we know how hard you've been working on the bills and initiatives for education across Alaska. And we do appreciate everything that you do. And we also want to express our appreciation to Governor Dunleavy and his team for sponsoring this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Superintendent Boyd. Senator Begich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Superintendent, does that mean that if we say no to this, that you'll continue to be superintendent?
Oh, I've got a few good years left in me. Don't say no.
Just checking.
Thanks. All right. Thank you, Superintendent Boyd. Senator Hughes.
Yes, and thank you for serving the students in your district, Dr. Boyd. I am just wondering if we're setting any precedent here. Having lived in Fort Yukon, if I'm remembering correctly, Rampart is southwest on the Yukon River. Are we adding an area that's going to be contiguous to what your district is, or are we doing some kind of carve-out? And is there any – I'm assuming there's no problem in that because the bills come forward, but – are we just kind of enlarging your borders and by bringing Rampart in, or is it not going to be contiguous?
I believe it is going to enlarge it just a bit, but if you look historically, you probably know this from living there, the cultural likeness to our district. We have 99% Athabascan students, and in Fort Yukon, I don't believe that's the case. And so it did just fit very nicely, and that was part of the start of the discussion many years ago. We do native language and courses across our district. They wanted to be part of that, and it won't be a problem for our district. I know this is something our board very much wants. The students are also, we care about them very deeply, and this is something that they're also wanting.
Follow up?
I don't know if Dee could speak to that. Just are we changing anything as far as how our borders and our school districts
You're looking
work?
At Ms. Teschner.
Yes, and I'm not saying it would be a bad thing to do. I mean, carving out might make sense, but I'm just wondering if we're just enlarging and if there's any rules around that you can only do that just for our knowledge basis here as the education committee.
Absolutely. For the record, Heidi Teschner, through the chair, Senator Hughes. The it is contiguous, so it's touchy. It's just a little. I'm going to say a little. I don't exactly have the square footage, but it is cutting a little bit out of Yukon Flats and adding that to Yukon Koyukuk. So not taking something out of the middle and moving it. It is right next door.
And as follow up, are there any rules that, let's say it were carving it out of the middle, would that be a problem? Do we have any guidance or statutes that would prevent that?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, I'm assuming if there was something in the middle and we made bound, you know, it said that it had to be part of, you know, based on the census of that community, then we would, that would limit how much you would be carving out of, say, a middle of it. But this is the only district I know of in this situation in the state where we need to move a school from one REA to another. But if we get to that point, I would want us to make sure the language in the law is very, very clear that it is limited to a certain area if it's in the middle of another district.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Senator Machicki.
Yeah, it's funny. When I first saw this bill, I worried about it a little bit. And then when I kind of dug into it and started asking people in both districts what the reaction was, I learned about essentially for 5 years. I would be more concerned if this had come to the legislature without the five-year trial period, and obviously everyone's still in support. But the big thing for me is the local control, that essentially it's education without representation, without the ability to vote for school board members. I have no concerns on this bill at all, and I appreciate that we did have the five-year trial period where folks have agreed it's the right way to go for both districts. Seems like this is more complicated than it needs to be on it actually coming to a bill after this period of time, but I guess that's how the statute's written, so I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Machicki. Senator Stevens.
It just seems perfectly reasonable, but is there any opposition at all to this occurring that you've heard?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, I have heard no opposition to this. The administration is fully in support, and I know, as you've heard, the districts are both in support, and I've heard of no other district that has issues with this.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Senator Stevens. Senator Begich.
Thank you. This is a map of the district. If you look on the east side, you'll see a break that cuts in, down and out. That's where Rampart is. So it actually straightens the line, and then there's an additional map that shows what it would look like with it in there. So there's actually a village to the east of Rampart that's in the school district. So this would actually make more sense than it does presently.
Finish the hole, make it more complete.
More compact, actually.
All right. Thank you, Senator Begich. We do also have Fred Beifeld, chair of the board of YK School District. And, sorry, we lost him. I guess he thought it was going so great. It's like, all right. Well, thank you all for your testimony. We'll now open public testimony on Senate Bill 198. Public testimony is now open on Senate Bill 198. Anyone in the room care to offer public testimony? Seeing no one, and I see no one online, so we're going to close public testimony on Senate Bill 198. Public testimony is now closed. This is a very short and straightforward bill. Are there any other questions from the committee? Seeing none, if there is no opposition, I'm comfortable with moving this bill along unless members need time to draft amendments. Senator Chickie, do you? No? All right. I will look to Senator Stevens for the will of the committee.
Mr. Chairman, I move that SB 198, Work Order 32-GS2062/A, be reported from the Senate Education Committee with individual recommendations and attached official notes.
All right. Without objection, Senate Bill 198 has been reported from the committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. Superintendent Boyd, thank you much for joining us. I'm glad the Senate Education Committee has been a small part of moving this along. Thank you, Ms. Teschner.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Much appreciated.
We'll take a brief at ease to sign some paperwork. All right, good morning. Senate Education is back on the record. The next item on today's agenda is Senate Bill 146 relating to textbook cost transparency. We'll now bring Senate Bill 146 before the committee. This is the first hearing of Senate Bill 146 in the 32nd legislature. The plan for today is to hear an introduction of the bill, take public testimony, and then hold the bill for further work. Senator Myers, would you and your staff please take a seat? Thank you. And place yourselves on the record and introduce your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Robert Myers. I'm Senator for District B up in North Pole and North Fairbanks. Joining me today is my staff, Dawson Mann. Today we're going to be presenting SB 146, the Textbook Cost Transparency Act. Before my aide presents a sectional analysis for the bill, I just wanted to speak to the sponsor statement a bit and give a little bit of the inspiration of the bill. So the Textbook Cost Transparency Act was inspired by a couple of calls we got from some UAF constituents reaching out to my office regarding the high cost of textbooks in their classes and issues of being able to afford the required class materials. Unfortunately, our hands as legislature, of course, are somewhat tied when it comes to dealing with the textbook publishing industry directly. So instead, we looked at making sure the students had as much information as possible regarding material costs. For many students, cost of materials can be a deciding factor in the decision to take a course due to the sometimes exorbitant prices of required course materials. Students often find themselves as consumers subject to a captive market that has experienced a colossal growth in price over the last decades. The Textbook Cost Transparency Act provides students with vital information about their textbook and course materials while they are registering for classes, allowing them to make informed decisions and financial plans. The goal of this legislation is to provide students with as much information regarding costs as early as possible in the registration process, with some clearly defined definitions integrated into the University of Alaska's Shared Online Course Catalog, also known as UA Online. By allowing students to see which classes come at zero cost or low cost, they'll be able to make more informed financial decisions more easily. And while faculty will remain, of course, the paramount deciders of class materials, we believe that by providing students this information, we will be building towards a more equitable and cost-effective university system for students at the class level.
Thank you, Senator Myers. Dawson, do you care to? Well, I'll just say, are there questions for the committee at this point? Seeing none. Dawson, do you care to do the sectional analysis?
Yes. Good morning, Chair Holland, Vice Chair Stevens, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dawson Mann, staff to Senator Myers, and I will be reading the brief sectional analysis for SB 146, the Textbook Cost Transparency Act. Section 1, page 1, lines 4 through 6. This section establishes that this act may be known as the Textbook Cost Transparency Act. Section 2, page 1, lines 7 through 14, page 2, lines 1 through 16. This section outlines the information that the University of Alaska must provide in the university system's online course schedule relating to class materials and automatic fees required for the materials. This section provides statute definitions for course material, online course schedule, zero-cost resources, and low-cost resources. This section also directs that the university's online course schedule must include search functions to identify courses with only zero-cost materials required. Section 3, page 2, line 17, establishes an effective date for the bill of July 1st, 2023.
Thank you, Mr. Mann. Are there any questions? Senator Stevens.
Chairman, there's been a position as a former history professor at the University of being really frustrated as textbooks would change and just minor changes, changing chapters, and it just so a student could not use their brother or sister's textbook because they had to change so much. And but is there another side to this? And I want to take the student's side on this, but is there another side that are we, things change in like in history textbooks. I want to make sure we're not being stuck with, I hate to give the advantage to the textbook manufacturers because they're so expensive, but are there any drawbacks in doing this? Any drawbacks that you see, Senator, in this plan?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, we worked with a couple of organizations at the university put together talking about textbooks. They helped us craft a lot of the definitions that's in this bill, and so we tried to give them a little bit of flexibility in the best way to implement the general concept as well. So we do have some invited testimony. If they see some drawbacks, we'd like to hear, but so far we haven't heard any specifics back from them.
Well, thank you. And your intention, of course, is to it's not interfere with faculty selection of textbooks, and they do that university-wide. So a textbook chosen, say, in U.S. history, it applies across the university system, I believe.
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, yes, it's not our intention to tell the faculty what textbooks to choose. We're simply asking that they release some information so that the students can make their choices as well.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate what you're doing. I think it's a good idea. I just am concerned that there are some unintended consequences out there that might be disadvantageous to the students.
Thank you, Senator Stevens. Senator Begich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator, how many states do this?
So through the chair, Senator Begich, so we modeled this off of legislation that passed most recently in Maryland, which I believe was in 2020, but we've also noted a few other states doing some other similar things in Washington and Oregon, a number of other places. Textbook costs have of course, been rising across the country. And so I'd have to look to my aide here to find an exact number of how many.
For the record, Dawson Mann, staff to Senator Myers. Legislation like this looks very differently in different states. In our research, we were able to find similar ideas, as the senator mentioned, in Maryland, which is the primary inspiration, but also in Washington, Oregon, Texas, and then some related statutes in Louisiana. And it's actually from the Louisiana definition of low-cost materials that we pulled and added into this legislation after conversations with university representatives.
Follow-up from Senator Begich.
I just handed out to folks because I knew Maryland had done this. I have a colleague, Mr. Chairman, Senator Cheryl Kagan in Maryland. She identified that it was Senator Rosa Pepe's bill. And this brings me up another question because I saw the fiscal note for this, and it shows this outrageously high amount of money, $822,900, for simply telling students what the value of a textbook was. So I reached out to the state of Maryland and asked for material that would underscore what the actual costs of such a thing are. And I just want to draw your attention to the fiscal summary. This is the equivalent of a fiscal and policy note that they do, like our fiscal notes. And if you just read that state effect, go to I'm going to just read it for the record. Once the online scheduling applications have been updated, USM, which is the University of Maryland, institutions can make the information regarding course materials available using existing resources, as explained below. Revenues are not materially affected, as effectively a zero fiscal note after the first year of implementation. And I just, looking at this fiscal note, Mr. Chairman, I'm shocked that the university has produced a fiscal note that shows an ongoing cost for this after implementation of nearly $1 million. And I wonder if the sponsor, you could speak to that fiscal note, or if it's something the university needs to speak to.
Through the chair, Senator Begich, we received the fiscal note, I believe, on Monday this week, and we contacted the university, and they've expressed that they wish to address that here in committee. They haven't given us too many specifics yet.
I have no follow-up. I want to hear from the university then on how they justify an ongoing expense of over $1 million for something that, where similar law has been implemented, there's no ongoing cost.
on that point.
Thank you, Senator Begich. Senator Hughes.
I also was shocked when I read the narrative accompanying the fiscal note. I have been an instructor, not at the college level, and I think in probably less than 5 minutes I could provide the information on the title of the textbook and the cost, and yet part of their fiscal note, they have 13,671 courses, and they're allowing an hour of staff faculty time for each of those courses to provide that information, and it's something, you know, I think that could be done in a minute or two, actually. So I'm very concerned about the fiscal note as well.
Senator Begich.
Again, I should have added that the University of Maryland has over 40,000 students in its student body, which is larger than the University of Alaska's, and they offer equally as many, if not more, courses. So I think that's important for the record. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Thank you, Senator Begich. With no other questions, thank you, Senator Myers. Thank you, Mr. Mann. We do have some invited testimony from, I see, Jennifer Moss, who is on Teams.
Good morning. Thank you.
I'm sorry. Ms. Moss, please stand by. Brief at ease. Senate Education is back in the record. Sorry for that brief interruption. We're just going to do a quick change here. We're going to have Sarah Perman present the fiscal note first, since that's come up as discussion. Ms. Perman, if you please place yourself on the record and begin the presentation of the fiscal note.
Through the chair, thank you so much to the members of the committee for having the university here. My name is Sarah Perman. I'm the Government Relations Manager for the University of Alaska. If you'll allow me for just a minute, I'll talk about the fiscal note, but maybe also the broader picture and prepare to get into the fiscal note. But then also we've got Michael Seary, who is the Vice Chancellor of UAS for Administrative Services, who has the really the fine details of that, but I can speak at a high level as well. First, I want to thank Senator Myers for bringing this bill up. We think that the university's priority is to educate Alaskans and expand the Alaskan workforce, and we acknowledge that to do so, we have to make education as accessible as possible, and in making it accessible, it has to be affordable. So we certainly value having a cost transparency bill, which puts it makes the costs available upfront for students, so there's no unexpected and unintended surprises. They're not signing up for a course and then finding out later, oh my gosh, I have to pay $600 a semester for my textbooks. You know, just as an anecdote, my senior year, I was paying that my first semester, and I figured out that second semester I could do all my work from online and spend my extra hours in course in office hours and save $600 a semester. But anecdotes aside, we are certainly grateful for this conversation, and the university is already actually taking several measures to make cost transparency with our textbooks, our course materials, and also make that listing accessible for university students so they can see ahead of time what the courses are and what they cost. At UAA, we have a zero cost textbook program, ZTC. We have a licensing through the Alaska Library Consortium Library, where materials are purchased by the university and are available to students for free. We also use our Academos library online bookstore to list out the materials for those courses as well as their costs. And we are beginning this summer to start marking the zero textbook courses in our scheduling platform in our registration course catalog. At UAF, we have material listings also available on our online bookstore, and we have those course fees and registration fees, et cetera, any kind of programming fees available on our UA online platform. That's available ahead of time during registration. Students can see that. And we have a search option in our course catalog for no-cost or low-cost courses. And then at UAS, since 2016, we've had an open UAS initiative. This is, you know, a piece brought forth by faculty and students saying they'd like to have textbook transparency and low cost and have these conversations. Since then, at least in 2021, almost 30% of our courses used no-cost materials at UAS. And we are currently developing a no-cost marker flagging in our online registration. As to the fiscal note, you know, we have flagged areas we are concerned with this bill, and it's not the concept of the bill, but it is certainly the pricing. There are two portions of this. There's the upfront capital cost, and then there's the ongoing component that Senator Begich spoke about earlier, this $822,000 a year. First, let me just talk about our $397,500 initial component. That is part of getting our information technology system aligned with this. We have a information technology system that dates back from the early 90s, I believe 1995, perhaps 1994, and this is a system-wide information technology system. It's old, it's tough to navigate, it's you know, we can't do a lot of our pieces online. This system contains student registration, financial fees, and employee costs, et cetera. It's a big kind of background system, and we have actually a $20 million capital request to help us upgrade that this year. But as we currently work through it, it is onerous and burdensome to update this and to get within the system the capacity to store our course information and then list the amount for those materials, what the materials are for each of that. It requires from our information of office technology, we have to design, develop, test, and implement the capabilities described in the legislation, including building new integrations with multiple third-party software vendors and refactoring the course catalog to support differentiation between materials for the same courses. That's, I should note that even we have, like you said, we have 13,671 courses. Some of those are duplicative courses, but individual instructors can choose what materials they want for those, even if they are the same course. So getting all of those pieces in the system, like I said, will require both third-party software.
Oh. Proceed.
Third-party software and then also internal staff hours. And we anticipate that the third-party contractors will charge $200 an hour at 1500 hours. And then we're also assuming $65 an hour at 1500 hours for internal staff work for just rebuilding out that system. That's our banner system. That's the front end work that goes with this for that $397,500 capital element of this. And then the $822,000, like Senator Begich and Senator Hughes mentioned, this is for those courses. We recognize that some professors have been doing this for years and may know ins and outs right away what their course materials will be able to look this right up. We also assume some courses, particularly ones that are high software components, that's a little bit more difficult to track down. So where we expect some may take 5 minutes, we anticipate some may take more than an hour. So we've used that number, 1 hour per course at $60 an hour to get that. And then also there's just an additional $2,600 component from Office of Information Technology for maintaining our larger banner system. And Michael Seary, the Vice Chancellor at UAS for Administrative Services, is prepared to speak more to that as well. And then I can wrap this up with that, just talking about the fiscal note, or if I might just wrap up my comments entirely.
And please proceed.
Thank you so much, the Chair. So we certainly, at the core, we support this concept. We really do want to provide course transparency and cost transparency for our students. In fact, we are in the middle of a Board of Regents meeting. It started yesterday and is continuing on today. And our a member of the Coalition of Student Leaders, who was here just a few weeks ago meeting with you guys in the Capitol, said they are encouraged by efforts to provide cost transparency in textbooks. That's really, or in course materials across the board. That's an effort they're very interested in, would like to see continued. And certainly we want that as well. We certainly don't want to find ourselves in a position where we are taking money that would go towards education programs and then putting it on the administrative end instead, and creating a large financial burden in that case that would take away from our students' educations in the long term. With that, I wrap up my brief remarks, and I pass it back to the chair.
Thank you, Ms. Perman. Senator Begich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Perman, you've described that you're already going through a process to do this. And so, again, I just go back to the fiscal note. You're already going through this process. So there, it's something you're able to do now under your current budget, and yet you've got a fiscal note here. When I see a fiscal note like this, what it says to me is that you don't want this bill. And so maybe that's something for the vice president, vice chancellor to speak to, but it says to me you don't want this bill. And if that's the case, I'd like to know why. And secondarily then, given you've described a process that is ongoing, that is designed to do this kind of cost transparency, I'm assuming then there's no cost in our budgets for that, or if there is a cost, let's identify that. And then finally, you mentioned a $20 million capital request that's in process now, which, you know, I'm certainly supportive of upgrading your computer system. I don't see why you couldn't deal within that capital request, since that request, A, hasn't been funded, and B, would need to, you know, be implemented, why you couldn't integrate this very process into that capital request. So I'm really quite, I'm not satisfied that this is a fair fiscal note. And I think, you know, as senators, and on the other body as legislators, House members, we have to rely on the departments to provide us, and the institutional, those who prepare the fiscal notes, to provide us accurate fiscal notes. Whether you're in the minority or in the majority, it's critical. You know, I Mr. Chairman, I reviewed once for President Kelly, when he was president of the Senate, fiscal notes on Medicaid reform. Now, I opposed what he was trying to do with Medicaid reform, but I went through 25 pages of fiscal notes at his request, and found literally $4 million in overcharges or inflated charges within those fiscal notes, and, you know, and share those with him, which we were able to get those fiscal notes to a reasonable level. I just want to know that we have transparency with our fiscal notes, because it affects me as a minority member as much as it affects any of the majority members, and I'm not satisfied. And I think you did a great job of describing what is, you know, what's entailed in the note. But the numbers that then the hedgeheads come up with do not satisfy me. They don't, as Senator von Imhoff would say, they don't pass the red face test. And so I have a real issue with this, and I'd like to maybe hear from the vice chancellor on that, in fairness to Senator Myers.
Okay. All right. A brief at ease. All right, thank you, Senate Education's back in the record. We do have Mike Seary, Vice Chancellor. If you care to wade into this conversation, please state your name, your affiliation, your location, and begin some invited testimony.
Thank you. My name again is Mike or Michael Seary. Either one works. I'm the Vice Chancellor for Administration at the University of Alaska Southeast. I also serve as the Director for Information Technology. So I cover a couple different roles here. So I'm effectively the Chief Financial Officer and also the Chief Information Officer here. I'm located in Juneau, and I'm pleased to have the chance to sit before you today. I want to begin by making sort of clear two things. One, I take a large portion of responsibility for that fiscal note that you see before you today. So to the degree to which it is not passing the blush test, I'm going to take some responsibility for that, and I will try to be as transparent with you as I possibly can, to sort of say to what degree was this based upon things we know, and to what degree was this based upon things that we don't know but are going to have to assume. But I also want to make very clear that I really personally support the goals of this legislation. I have personally led a team here in Southeast that has worked directly on the course schedule for more than 20 years on that project specifically, with a goal of making the cost clear to the penny for students registering. That's the goal for the team. Is we want a student who's looking at a course they're thinking about registering for to have a to-the-penny accurate understanding of that course. And that is unfortunately far more difficult than it would seem, but I want to make clear that not just do we want them to know that a course is going to cost a certain amount, but we've also worked to try to make it clear where those costs come from. To what degree is that tuition? To what degree is that fees? To what degree is that materials? So if this is the larger goal that certainly my team shares, and I know is shared by many people like me across the university system. So I just want to make very clear that the outcome I think that we're all after is one that we are passionate about and do share. I also, as I said, I began my career in information technology, and I am the director of information technology. And I think that one of the jobs of a person in my position is to be clear about potential costs and risks, because too often these IT projects become far more expensive than they should be, and there's cost overruns are just very typical. So I do try to, if you will, err on the side of what how might these costs escalate. The point was raised earlier about the Student Information Modernization Project and why can't some of these goals be accomplished within that project. And I would actually say I would really hope they could be accomplished within that project. That is one of the reasons why this is such a high priority, because, as I said, we share this goal of being transparent in costs. The effective date of this bill would come long before that modernization project was done. And so we would be in a position of needing to have something ready. Even if we got funded and were well underway with that project would not be in place in the timeline of this bill. And so the fiscal note that you see is based upon the assumption that we do not have that project in place. But I share the perspective that were we able to modernize our SIS system, this and frankly many other obstacles for our students would likely become far, far easier. So that's the first point on the fiscal notes. It's based on the assumption that we either have not been able to receive the funding for this or that it's not complete, because, as I said, even if we receive funding, the timeline will not have that modernization completed by next year. The part of why our current information system makes this expensive is that our current system has no capability to store the data that we're talking about. And so we would need to be contracting with the vendor on how we could modify the current information system so that it could even store the information that we hope to present to students. Currently, we do make this information available as best we can through our bookstore systems. We actually have a requirement under at the federal level to make textbook costs visible to students. And so students, we strive to have those costs visible to students through our bookstore systems at the point in time where, of course, registration comes up. So, again, trying to share the goal of this bill. But there is no integration between our student information system and those bookstore systems. And so there's not a way that we have currently to tie the workload that goes into maintaining the bookstore systems into what we could do with our course schedule. And so, again, frankly, for me, it's a source of great frustration because I would like to very much solve that. It, again, is one of those things that we would hope to address through this process. The one-hour estimate, again, I will take responsibility. I'm the one who came up with that. And so to the degree to which that is difficult to defend or shocking to the committee, please accept my apology. And I will, but do know that within that, I was counting on things like the cost for resolving technical issues, as faculty have, our help desk costs, as we do, but probably most specifically compliance issues, because right now our methodology for really moving the needle on textbook costs and transparency has been to work with faculty in a educational mode and teaching them and bringing them along. With this bill, this would become now a compliance issue where we would need to have staff engaged in ensuring compliance for new faculty that are coming in and hunting down the adjunct that we just brought in and making sure they understand the obligation, et cetera. So there is, in fact, I didn't line item all those different hours. Perhaps I should have for the committee. I don't necessarily think that a faculty member is going to spend an hour themselves doing it, but it was meant to represent other staff involved in it as well. And again, as I look at that time, I ask a little bit of indulgence from the committee in that we don't have a system to do this now. And so we do not know what the workload for a faculty member would be. There are some other nuances to the fiscal note, but I'd like to hold on that maybe for a moment and just address the larger question that was asked about unintended consequences. Recognizing, again, this is a goal that I share. I've been a part of the university for nearly 40 years, and reducing these costs and making it work is something that's very important to me. The concern that I have is it's not clear to me under this bill what happens when the textbooks or the resources change between the time the schedule goes up and the time the course gets taught, and whether we would be found to be out of compliance. The concern is faculty continue to work on their course resources right up until the very start of the semester. And should the unintended consequence of this bill be that we need to discourage that type of continuous improvement, we would be asking faculty to be making their course resource decisions, in the case of the fall semester, in the late preceding fall. It's also not clear to me how we would accommodate adjunct faculty who may be brought on to teach a class long after the course schedule went up. In those cases, the resources may not get pinned down until quite a bit later. So I have just some concerns about, one of my roles is compliance. And if we push for strict compliance, will an unintended consequence be creating barriers for faculty trying to, frankly, find low-cost alternatives to the original textbooks that they picked at the time the course schedule went up? I would much rather they did make those decisions. So that's not really a fiscal note issue, but it is one that I wanted to bring up. I would be happy to address any questions or concerns that the chair of the committee would like to have.
Thank you, Vice Chancellor Siri. Senator Machicki?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I here's what I think is happening here, so I don't make it sound nefarious from anyone who's involved. The university could get better at reaching out to a sponsor with some suggestions on how this could work instead of dropping a bomb of what no one at this desk likely finds acceptable in this fiscal note. And I'm a nice guy. I'm a proud graduate of the system and stayed here. But course catalogs are not a cut and paste every year. You've got staff that are reviewing what is going into those sections. So what would be some out-of-the-box suggestions? How about just the course has a link, or each textbook that's in the system could have a unique identifier. The course could say the range for what's expected in this due to these items that are coded is approximately $784, and you could have a link in your system on your online course catalog that links to that actual textbook for students to see what the actual cost is. We know things can change. How would you handle this? Speak with the sponsor, talk about ways that you can make it work without a bomb like this. And I just want to note, in the movie Elf, James Caan made the naughty list because of nefarious book practices, and you can't tell me that publishers don't play some of those games. I don't want you guys to be on the naughty list. You shouldn't be dragged into that. So what can you do with meeting with the sponsor? I believe in this, and I'll tell you, here's what I think it does. It forces instructors to talk or to think about the cost to students, where they're not thinking of that right now. And I still have my textbooks from college because I remember what I paid for them. I know they're not worth them. They should be fire starter now. But, you know, that $187 book that is no longer relevant in anything at the time, that was a lot of money to me, right? I think it'll force instructors to think about the bottom line cost to students of their textbook options. And what another thing I remember is an instructor would choose a, you know, $160 textbook because of two chapters in that book where 90% of the course material was the lower cost stuff that was outside of that textbook. I think this will force instructors to think about those choices and make better choices on their course material. So I believe in the system. I think perhaps I know we're going to hold this bill. I think it gives a great opportunity for the university to get with the sponsor and look at something that works. Perhaps it's an effective date adjustment until there is an option available. But nobody buys this, and it hurts the university when folks just don't buy the fiscal note. It just does. And Senator Begich said it, you don't like the bill. I think there are several options. You don't like the bill, you want to justify the capital request, or you want to offset other reductions in the university system. And this bill doesn't deserve to get negatively impacted for any of those reasons. We're talking about this bill, which I think has a lot of value. So just a recommendation. If you want to respond, that's great. I hope you don't take that negatively. But we do see this fiscal note game happen on a lot of bills, and I think we're getting sort of worn out with it.
Thank you, Senator Machicki. At this time, I'll go to Senator Begich.
Can you give the chancellor a chance to respond to that?
Chancellor Siri, do you have any response?
Through the chair, I take your point, Senator Machicki. And certainly, I think we would welcome the opportunity to work with the bill sponsor. Certainly, I think that again, I am, by the way, on that steering committee for that SIS modernization. I'm passionate about getting there. And I think that some of the ideas that you're saying about what are other ways to get there, you know, those are the types of things that we are thinking about. So I apologize if this comes across as having some other intent than it is. I would say that the faculty I talked to do care very much about the cost of textbooks. Not everyone. We have thousands of faculty members, so I can't speak for all of them. But I think that the progress and the efforts that you heard about earlier, these are faculty-led. These are efforts to reduce textbook costs that are led by the faculty themselves, and so they are working on them directly. So I will. You certainly have my commitment to work on ways that we can get there. My own concern is that the bill itself, and I recognize we have to be respectful of the faculty's role, but the faculty member right now who is already needing to gather the cost information for our bookstore system, you know, is already making that information visible. And so I think that finding ways that do accomplish the ultimate goal of reducing the textbook costs and increasing the transparency will benefit both the university and the students and the state.
Thank you, Chancellor. Senator Begich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Vice Chancellor, the thing that I've caught out of all of this conversation is the need to take a 1995 system and upgrade it. So I would ask, you know, if indeed the system was upgraded, would this fiscal note even exist at this level? If the system were upgraded, it sounds to me from what you were saying earlier that most of this would evaporate. Is that what I'm hearing?
Through the chair, thank you, Senator. I want to. It's hard for me to respond because, again, my role is as the IT person, and I'm passionate about automation. For me, it's offensive that we can't integrate systems together. Anytime a person duplicate enters information, that's a waste of state money. That drives up the cost of tuition, and so I'm you may have picked up I'm quite passionate about this, and so from my perspective, the information about textbooks should be entered once ever per course section, and there should be no duplicate entry. You know, it should feed into the bookstore systems, it should feed into the student information system, it should be visible in the course schedule. You know, in my mind, it should be visible through the course websites that we publish for our students, and we should not be requiring anybody to have to be entering that information more than once because we should be putting our resources into serving the students. And so, you know, that to me is what we need to be doing. And should, if that were to be the case, then from my perspective, my main concern is simply making it clear what if we continue to refine textbook lists after the course schedule goes up, are we complying with this bill or are we out of compliance with the bill? That would be my remaining concern would simply be that and not the fiscal side of it.
Follow up, Senator Begich.
Thank you, and I appreciate that last comment too, because I think that's something the sponsor could address in the bill in terms of, you know, sort of nuanced language, and it may be something one of the other states that does that. My follow up is just to say that I would like to have a chance to meet with your folks and review that capital request for the $20 million for the system. And I'd just personally like to see what that is and spend some time working with you guys as to how to achieve that. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
At this point, we do have a member of the public who's patiently been waiting. So we're going to jump to public testimony real quick. At this point, I'm going to open up public testimony on Senate Bill 146. Public testimony is now open. And I see I have Jeffrey Cruz standing by on the phone. And if you can hear me, Mr. Cruz, please state your name, any affiliation, and your location. And we're going to give you 2 to 3 minutes for some public testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jeffrey Cruz. I'm from Anchorage. I'm representing myself. Actually, technically, I'm on J-Bear. I'm a U.S. Coast Guard veteran. I wanted to add my testimony in support of this bill. I'm a returning student. I'm coming back after a 20-year hiatus. Look, I love UAA, and I don't need to tell you, since you all seem like you've got some real good experience being educators, but in the 20 years since I first went to college, the cost of textbooks has gone up about 300%. And I'd like to say that my book stipend from the VA covers all of my textbooks every semester. Usually it's like $300 and something, $350 a semester, which is great, but it doesn't always cover that. I take a lot of technical classes. I'm in the psychology program. Sometimes I'll have a psychology textbook that's electronic that costs $75 that I don't get to keep. And, you know, I have a homework system with that and everything else, but it's really expensive. As a veteran, right now, I just retired out. I'm kind of on a fixed salary. So any expenses that are in addition to my tuition or on top of, you know, what I am expecting to pay, hurt. They take food out of my mouth. They, you know, get in the way of rent. You know, I have to take at least 12 credit hours a month to get my GI Bill stipend for housing. And if I wasn't getting that, I would be in a lot of trouble. And it would mean me having to take extra jobs, you know, work longer and do all sorts of other things to be able to afford living here and going to school here. So I, you know, you're going to hear or you heard that kind of UA has a lot of financial objections to this bill becoming law. You know, they're saying, you know, that it's too expensive to upgrade the system. And they're also saying, hey, we're already doing it. I don't know how many of you were in the military, but a lot of times this is what gets done in the military to ensure that a new and unpopular regulation quietly gets killed. You know, these ideas are driven by, you know, exceptional people that kind of pushed out. And once those people leave or move, they just fall by the wayside. And if we allow course marking to be up to the universities, they'll do it for a while. And then, you know, there'll be another cost or something else, and the people that care about it are gone, and everything gets streamlined, and that job's cut, and then nobody's going to do that anymore. And the people that are hurt are students, and we're really not asking for anything that's that hard. We're just asking that the universities clearly mark the cost of a class, so we can decide whether taking that class fits our budget. A good example of that is, so I had an opportunity 2 semesters ago to take a class in community psychology, which was a great class. There were 2 course offerings for that class. And I didn't know this at the time, but one of those classes offered a free open textbook for community psychology. And the other course offered a textbook that cost $50. Well, I not knowing that there was any real difference between the classes, I took the one that cost $50. And by the time I found out that it cost $50 and I was going through the bookstore system, it was really too late to fix my schedule and move things around and do everything. For a student that wasn't getting assistance from the VA, that might mean I have to drop out, or I don't buy the textbook and I fail the class, or I try to figure out something else. And that's a situation where I had a physical textbook. I know people that have electronic versions of textbooks that have quizzes that they have to take, that they find out after they get the course that it costs, you know, $150 to get the book and the homework system, and they've already signed up for the class and they thought they've already kind of paid for everything. So that's my concern. That's why I really think this bill is good. Yes, I understand that the university will incur some costs in implementing this, but honestly, the cost that they'll recoup by having additional students want to sign up for classes that they can afford and not be surprised by stuff should probably offset that, to be honest. And that's really all I have to say. I'll stay on if anybody has any questions or you know, questions about my experience.
Well, from one Coast Guard veteran to another, Mr. Cruz, thank you for your service. Thank you for your patience. Are there any public testimonies? Your chance to kind of provide public testimony, not be cross-examined by the committee. But I will. There's no more public testimony online. Standing by, I'll ask if there's anyone in the room caring to offer public testimony. Seeing none, I'll close public testimony at this time. Public testimony is now closed on Senate Bill Number 146. Senator Stevens, did you have a comment or question?
Oh, just a couple of thoughts. I mean, I really appreciate the attention to this issue. I know that textbooks are extremely expensive, and it can really be discouraging to the students. We want to find places to lower the costs where we can. Certainly don't want to kill this, but I'd like to hear from the faculty on this matter to see what their reactions are. I know faculty do concern themselves with the cost of a textbook and the impact it has. You know, I guess I'm back, going back to unintended consequences, and I heard you use the term vice chancellor of strict compliance. That makes me a little nervous. What does strict compliance mean? You know, texts change, resources change. You know, I want to make sure that we're not denying a professor or discouraging them from choosing the newest textbooks or maybe cutting edge material and so the benefit here has to be the student. You know, comparing the last gentleman speaking, you know, comparing a class that had a no cost to the text versus a class that had a cost to the text, the same class, you know, are we denying the students the most up-to-date information by providing only the free material? So just a general comment, I'd like to hear from students from professors on this as well. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Senator Stevens. Senator Hughes.
Yes, I'm just going to mention the concern about the compliance that could easily be resolved by amending the bill that it be pinned to a publication date with a note to students that it was subject to change and that they should check with the bookstore to know the current cost. So that's easily remedied, and I'd be happy to work with the sponsor on language in that regard. And with the university. I also think this has been an excellent discussion, Mr. Chair. I agree with Senator Begich and Senator Michicki very much that this needs to be worked out. And so I hope that there can be conversations. And I think moving the effective date might be one way also, in that it sounds like you're needing to change your system. I do appreciate the students. Testimony, Jeffrey Cruz, that was excellent observation on your part, listening to the entire hearing in regard to the fact that the three main campuses are already doing things along these lines, and but yet concerned that they can't do what the bill's asking. So anyway, thank you.
Thank you, Senator Hughes. Ms. Perman.
Through the chair, I just wanted to take a moment to respond and say thank you to all of the concerns that each of you have brought up. I particularly wanted to address the concerns from Senator Michicki and just say I hear you loud and clear about those three components and what you see when you look at this fiscal note, and I take that to heart. And I, from on behalf of the university, say we will in earnest and sincerely work with the sponsor of this bill, we're happy to do that. And like I said, at the bottom of it, at the core of it, we also really value this legislation. So thank you for your comments and for your feedback, and we will incorporate that. And I also welcome the conversation with Senator Begich about our capital request. We will be happy to do that.
All right. At this time, I will apologize. We're going to be crunched for time. We do have an early Senate floor session, but I do anticipate there will be many productive conversations between the stakeholders and the sponsor. At this time, I'm going to set Senate Bill 146 aside. And is there any other business before the committee? Seeing none, our next meeting is Monday, February 28th at 9 a.m. We are adjourned at 10:17. Thank you.